The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Guardian Football Weekly Extra. It's time for the Nations League. So important, surely all other football should be cancelled. Can James Rodriguez do it on a cold night at Goodison? The Women's Super League returns. We'll be finding out some of the star names arriving to ply their trade over in England. And we speculate on what impact Lionel Messi would make at Bolton Wanderers in the company of our second super sub. All that and more on today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. So it's a Hollywood lineup Jose would be jealous of on the panel today. Lars Sivertsen, you look as if you are broadcasting from the Norwegian fjords with that wonderful Zoom background you have.
Yeah, I set a comedy Zoom background on a different episode and now I'm not quite sure how to remove it.
Well, it looks like you've just got your own little cabin. It looks quite cute.
Well, I think the reason I set it was that we had another guest on who had also at one point set a comedy background and now didn't know how to remove it. So this seems just contagious.
All right, well, I like it.
But you know, I give you all a blast of the fjords this morning. I think it's what you all need to feel better about the world.
I feel refreshed, that's for sure. Jonathan Wilson, you've gone very standard Zoom in lockdown with the wonderful bookcase you have behind you. How are you doing?
Well, I haven't really gone anywhere. It's just what my room looks like. But I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Very good, very good.
This isn't a backdrop, this is genuine.
I
could
know.
Go over there and I could take a book out.
I know, but that's what's impressive about it. It's very, very Jonathan Wilson. Barry Glendening, wonderful new haircut, a buzz cut.
Thank you, yes. Self-inflicted blade one. I put the wrong fixture on the clippers and it was too late when I realised my mistake. I had to continue. I was all in.
Well, you didn't fancy going for the crew?
That's too complex. But I quite like my lack of hair.
I think it suits you, very much so. Listen, we have much more important things to get on to, including lots of important listener questions to address as well, including this one from Zvir B. Enich. What kind of crazy energy drink is Lars Sivertsen having today?
This is where this comes from. I had some really strange energy drink before a podcast once, and I went a bit odd. But it doesn't mean I do it every time, because I think that would have negative repercussions for my career and life in general.
Now, you said you went a bit odd. What do you mean? I'd quite like to see this.
Too excited, Faye. I had about 10 espressos and was ready to go.
Wow.
Which is not what you want. Well, sometimes it is what you want, but not now.
Listen, we always get an energetic Lars Sivertsen. I'm not sure if we need extra energy, that's for sure. Right, Nations League preview. According to Johnny Liu, more of the games you love in a format that you'll hate. Johnny also asked in his Guardian piece today, is it a great idea to be forcing players and staff to fly all over the continent in the middle of a pandemic? And does it really need to be 18 months long? Games are starting tonight, continuing every night until Tuesday. All 170 Nations League games will be available to watch on Sky. Come on, Barry, which ones won't you be watching?
Well, there's quite a few I won't be watching, because the one I'll be watching tonight at the expense of the others will be Bulgaria against the Republic of Ireland. I like the Nations League. I think Johnny Liu is probably right in that it's not a very good idea to have all these teams and their staff flying around the continent during a pandemic, but football seems to think it's that the coronavirus is beneath it and not worthy of its consideration. And there was talk that the Nations League should be cancelled, but the fact of the matter is it's like every other football match being played at the moment. It's sort of going ahead purely for financial reasons, in that the respective football associations in poorer countries really need the money. The Republic of Ireland, the Football Association of Ireland certainly need the money. But I like the Nations League as a concept. I think it was a good idea. Friendly internationals were just unspeakably dull. But this is a tournament that's worth winning, worth doing well in. So I like it.
Yeah, I'd agree with you on that. I like it as well. Also, just to balance it out slightly, perhaps UEFA are looking at it in terms of what Euro 2020 in 2021 would look like and whether or not it is going to be feasible to play that in 12 countries or not, or whether or not they have to have a little bit of a rethink. It's not very straightforward though, is it? On Friday night, Scotland play Israel in the Nations League. Next month, Scotland play Israel again. this time in their Euro playoff semi-final. Then in November, Scotland meet Israel for a third time in their reverse Nations League fixture. Wilson, you've said the Nations League is the best idea anybody in football admins had for years. Not a particularly high benchmark, as we know. All other football, you believe, should be cancelled to make way for it. Why do you think that?
That was a slightly flippant exaggeration, but I do think it's a really great idea because it generates revenue for the federations that really need it. And it generates football between teams of roughly equal level, which is the problem international football always has. That one of the reasons it becomes unwatchable in the qualifying phases of tournaments is you get the big teams, you get France or Germany or Italy or Netherlands or England playing against Andorra or San Marino when 6-0 is a bad score, and you get one team just defends. And, the best football is when two teams are roughly the same level and there is a balance of attack and defence. So this has created a format that does that. And, I take the point that the travelling across Europe maybe not isn't the greatest idea at the minute. But I slightly disagree with Barry about the idea that football thinks that COVID's beneath it. It's put in place incredibly successful and quite complicated structures to protect players, which have been very successful, and this is an extension of that. And I think you're right. It's a useful test looking ahead to the Euros next summer, and how that can work with people having to travel across the continent. So, I think money may be the driver, but I think Barry's slightly unfair on football in saying it's sort of disdaining the virus. It's taken it really seriously and has actually got it right, and we probably should praise the authorities for that.
That's interesting, Lars. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think if we want to talk about people who seem to think that the virus is beneath them, I'd start with the players who go off to Greek party islands. Before I start on the football authorities, the testing regime seems to be very, very stringent. And to my knowledge, we haven't really had any major sort of outbreaks in connection with the restart of football or travel like this. So it seems to be going quite well with all the testing.
Well, that's put me back in my box, hasn't it?
Boom.
Definitely. I love it when Barry gets put back in his box. Certainly when you listen to some of the English journos who are out in Iceland at the moment, they've had to be out there for the past 4 days or so because they have to isolate for 5 days when they first arrive. And they're being very, very strict by the sounds of it out in Reykjavik. So that game is on Saturday. Obviously, Iceland beat England in the Euros 4 years ago in that embarrassing display under Roy Hodgson. Will there be any surprise in Gareth Southgate's starting 11, Wilson?
I think it's such an odd squad, there almost has to be surprises. I still can't quite work out who's going to play at left back. I don't know if Maitland-Niles has been brought in to do that, but if that is the case, why was he brought in late? What was the initial plan? So I don't know if it's a surprise, but I have no idea what team he's going to pick.
It's going to be really interesting to see what Gareth Southgate does formation-wise, of course. He's brought Connor Cody in, Wolves defender and captain, who's used to playing in a back three for his club. And obviously, as Wilson has already said, no recognised left-back. So what are we expecting him to do? I mean, three at the back worked really well for him at the World Cup in Russia, Lars.
It could be that, but I feel like people are also forgetting that Tyrone Mings has played half his career at left-back. It's not what he does these days, but it's somewhere he's played an awful lot. So I think shoving him in there for a game or two is probably not the sort of weirdest thing you could come up with in the grand scheme of things. And as mentioned, Ainsley Maitland-Niles seems to be able to play pretty much anywhere you tell him to. So they have options there.
Yeah, he was impressive in the Community Shield for sure. Tell us what this current Iceland team is like, Lars, because obviously they caught England by surprise 4 years ago.
They did, and they're obviously not a bad team, but I wouldn't... It's tough for them because obviously they're a very, very small country, as I think people have mentioned before. So they are really reliant on getting good generations through. And if you look at the squad here, that they're bringing in a couple of younger players, but they actually have two guys in the squad who I believe are without a club at the moment. So you have like unattached guys in the squad, which is never a mega good sign. And I wouldn't expect them to carry on the sort of extraordinary results that they've had in the last few years, indefinitely.
Yeah, let's not call them minnows. That kind of thing drives me mad.
No, absolutely not. But at the same time, it's easy to say, oh, well, they've been to international tournaments and they've taken good scalps, so now we should expect them to be one of the heavyweights forever, which I think is unreasonable given the size of the population and all that. So they have to try to freshen up the squad a bit. Some of the players were getting a bit old. But, of course, the talent pool isn't huge. So I'm sure they'll continue to confound expectations in a big way, but it's a team England should beat.
Yeah. As we've mentioned already, Scotland play Israel three times. Barry, they almost have a great squad, you think?
Yeah, it's a kind of weird one. You look at their squad, defence, they've got obviously Andy Robertson and Kieran Tierney, but they're both excellent left backs, but they're both left backs. So do you leave one of them out? Or Andy Robertson obviously would be the first choice. So do you play Kieran Tierney as a left-sided centre-half, or do you leave him on the bench? It's difficult to know. It would be a shame to have him available and not use him. And then they're sort of spoiled for choice with quite a few middling to good centre midfielders. Ryan Jack, Callum McGregor, Scott McTominay, Stuart Armstrong, Kenny McLean, John Fleck, Billy Gilmore emerging at Chelsea. And up front, they're a bit light. Ollie McBurney is pulled out. John McGinn plays as a sort of behind the striker when he's on Scotland duty. They're missing Ryan Fraser, who just isn't anywhere near match fit. No Stephen Naismith, no Craig Gordon. Yeah, Scotland have a good squad on paper, and it remains to be seen how they will fare on grass.
Now listen, Barry, where you've buzzed your hair off, was it because of pure jealousy of Gareth Bale's absolutely glorious lion's mane, which is plastered all over the back pages today?
Yeah, I saw that picture yesterday. It reminded me of sort of the Timotei ads back in the 1980s or 90s, where you had that blonde lady throwing back her luscious locks after washing them in outside in a pond or something. But
waterfall in a waterfall.
Was it yeah, not a pond. That's why I don't work in advertising. I'd have had her, yeah, kneeling beside a big puddle. Gareth Bale has been, you know, obviously not getting a game at Real Madrid. Loves going on, famously loves playing for Wales. So he did an interview with Sky yesterday, talking about his club situation, saying he's open to a move, but Real Madrid keep putting obstacles in his way. But the Wales squad, he obviously has turned up because he always does, but they're missing a lot of players for various reasons. Aaron Ramsey, David Brooks, Tyler Roberts, Ashley Williams, Joe Allen, Chris Meffham, James Chester and Joe Roden all out. And Nico Williams from Liverpool has been called up. He may start. Sam Vokes has been dropped, so it looks like his time as a Welsh international is over.
Wales are away against Finland. What are we expecting from them?
They've done well recently, Finland. They qualified for the Euros, which I do believe is the first time they've gotten to a major tournament, certainly in modern times, fueled by a string of late goals from Teemu Pukki, as you would expect, and a team that looked sort of pretty solid. So they're no pushovers in the way you would perhaps expect the Finns to be in earlier years.
Stephen Kenny, it's his first game in charge. I'm really excited about it. He certainly talks a good game about the expansive, free-flowing, possession-based style of football the Republic of Ireland are going to play. I do wonder, like Brian Kerr before him, most of his experience is League of Ireland. Kerr also managed the League of Ireland and had great success with Ireland underage teams. I wonder how many of the senior professionals in the Ireland squad who probably had no idea who Stephen Kenny was before he was appointed, how they will react to his appointment. You know, there is a worry that they'll go, who's this guy or what the hell does he know about football? I think that may have happened under Brian Kerr as well. Brian Kerr's problem as well, I think he got the big job he'd always wanted and then was a bit too cautious. A couple of weeks ago, Jason McAteer said that the Irish professionals, Premier League players, won't rate Stephen Kenny. But then Jason McAteer, while I hold him in the highest regard, his sort of only managerial experience was, I think, as an assistant manager to John Barnes at Tranmere, where they both, you know, bombed spectacularly. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to this brave new age of Irish football, and I hope if Stephen Kenny's team plays half as good a game as he talks, then it should be quite exciting.
I mean, he is a really impressive figure. I did an event in Dublin. Was it only last December or was it the December before? And he was on immediately before me, so we had a chat in the dressing room, and I watched him on stage, and he was you know, he was great on stage, he was great off stage. He's very eloquent, he's very succinct at getting his ideas across. And I wonder, I mean, I know it was much mocked at the time, but the sort of the Irish succession plan, where we've known he was going to be the senior manager for 2 years, whether that actually helps alleviate some of the problems that Brian Kerr faced, that the players have been sort of prepared for him coming in. And his record with the under-21s is so good, and they've played such good football, and presumably he will do everything he can to integrate those under-21s in the senior squad, that maybe it won't be quite such an issue of who is this guy.
I think he's also, I mean, he did the job he did at Dundalk. They played some really nice football, and obviously they got to the group stage of the Europa League and you know, represented themselves very well there. If there are sort of England-based Irish players in the squad who think playing for Stephen Kenny is kind of beneath them, maybe they should get over themselves, because they've not achieved all that much, quite a few of those either.
I have to say, I really like Brian Kerr, because he must have been doing some kind of TV gig for some Irish station when Ireland had that playoff in Bosnia. And we ended up the night before the game in the same bar in Sarajevo drinking schnapps. And I'd never spoken to him before. But, you know, he obviously saw me and saw I was with other journalists, and we had a bit of a chat. And since then, he has always acknowledged me, and I'm absolutely certain he has no idea how he knows me, but just knows I've seen him somewhere before.
Well, Brian Kerr is kind of a national treasure in Ireland, and I think a lot of people were quite sad that it didn't quite work out for him as Ireland boss. He did all right, but they just drew far too many games that they could and should have won, and I think everyone really wanted him to succeed, and I suspect it's the same now with Stephen Kenny. Everyone will really want him to succeed.
A couple of good games that we should all be looking forward to. Germany against Spain, and then France against Croatia next Tuesday, which is a repeat of the World Cup final, Jonathan.
Yeah, and also if you look down as a Group B, I think that Russia-Serbia game, which is tonight. Yeah, tonight. I think they're probably the best two teams outside of Group A. I think that's probably worth watching as well.
Yeah, and Netherlands, Poland as well. Right, that's enough for part one. Coming up in part two, Flo Lloyd-Hughes joins us for a Women's Super League preview. And much to Barry's delight, we talk transfers. Welcome to part two of Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Flo Lloyd-Hughes is with us. An absolute pleasure to see you, Sandra. You can explain that one if you like.
Yeah, exactly. I've been giggling this morning because some guy rang me up, a tech support guy, and said, "Hi, Sandra." And I said, oh, I think you got the wrong number. And he said, "Oh, no, sorry. Hi, Florence." So, yeah, apparently I'm Sandra now.
Was it Harry Redknapp?
No, it would have been great if it was, though. He's now working in tech support.
So it looks very much as if it's going to be one of the most exciting FAWSLs for a very long time. So much talent flocking, particularly from the US, over to the UK, which kind of begs the question, is the WSL now the top women's competition in the world, Flo?
I think so. I think this season's going to be hopefully one of the most competitive. I think there are standout teams around the world, but in terms of a competitive league with at least, you know, 2 to 3 teams fighting for the title, the WSL certainly looks like it's going to be really exciting this season. And we obviously know that around Europe, you've got leagues where you have dominant teams like Wolfsburg and Lyon, and maybe PSG and Bayern Munich sort of trying to get in there, but those two teams really dominating everything, and obviously Glasgow in Scotland really up until this point. So I think it bodes well for England being able to have this many teams who are willing to invest and really create a competitive force for professional women's football.
I mean, you said Wolfsburg there, but they've lost a massive name in Pernilla Harder, who signed for Chelsea Women. World record transfer fee as well, thought to be around £300,000. I know she only had 10 months left on her contract there, but 103 goals in 112 games for the club. And it really looks as if Chelsea manager Emma Hayes means business.
Yeah, it's a big move. Lots of people expected her to come next season because her contract was going to be up. So I think it did take a few people by surprise, and the news sort of was announced within days of the rumour resurfacing after it initially sort of coming to a head in the summer, really. So I think it's really exciting for the league. Obviously, the fact that her partner Magdalena Eriksson's there was a big draw as well. And with Eriksson being the captain, that's a big plus for them to be able to get Harder to come over. So it's so exciting for the league. And obviously you mentioned the US players as well coming over. So hopefully fans will be able to get back in soon and witness what could be a really historic season for the league.
How's she going to fit in at Chelsea though? Because there's going to be massive competition for places, and there already was beforehand.
Yeah, I mean, Chelsea have gone for an interesting one. I think they are trying to emulate the Lyon dynasty a little bit with stockpiling incredible talent. And I've said it before in this podcast, but you don't need to spend comparatively a lot of money in women's football to create a Galactico women's setup. I mean, Lyon have done that with, you know, I think people are saying the budget's around 10 million euros a year. So you can spend comparatively not that much money and have a really ridiculously good, you know, football manager style team on your hands. And that's what Chelsea are going for. The club have backed Emma Hayes, and they believe in her, and they believe in her vision, and they are determined to win the Champions League. And if stockpiling global talent for £500,000 is how they do it, then they're going to do it. And it looks great for the brand as well. You know, Chelsea have previously been fighting, you know, perhaps a bit of a negative reputation, and having a really successful women's team helps build that brand.
On that note, Flo, can I ask, if you can assemble a good team for a relative pittance or comparative pittance when looking at a men's side, and it's good, obviously good for the brand, why do Liverpool treat their women's team with such utter contempt?
That's a great question, Barry, and I would love to know. It makes no sense to me. I know I've talked about it millions of times on this podcast with you. I know you've talked about it on other shows, and lots of Liverpool fans are pissed off about the situation as well, which I think is good, and they've spoken up about it. And it doesn't make sense that one of the most profitable clubs in the world can't, you know, shell out a couple million quid to invest in a women's team and make it be successful when they have in the past. When you look at the England women's team, you've got players who have played at Liverpool and been part of that. They won WSL titles. So it makes no sense that now the game's got a little bit more expensive, they don't want to really be part of it. And I think it's unfair on the women's players that have been there. It's unfair on the coach, and it's unfair on the fans. And hopefully Liverpool getting relegated will be a bit of a wake-up call, but it's hard to know. I think I did read recently that they are reassessing the training ground situation, and they may be letting the women, or there are plans to let the women be part of that, because they're obviously building this ridiculously amazing training ground. And initially the reports were that the women weren't going to be part of it. And obviously everyone was really disappointed in that, because most clubs are now moving towards letting the women have access to the main facilities. So hopefully if they do change that, then it will provide better facilities, better support for the players, and the team can build back up again.
And other clubs are starting to take Arsenal, Manchester City and Chelsea's lead as well. You see what Aston Villa are doing, just been promoted from the Championship, and Leicester have just announced that their women's team's going to go professional. They ply their trade in the Championship as well. We need to touch on Manchester City, Flo, because, you know, we've talked about the signings that Chelsea have made, but Man City snapping up two of the USA's World Cup winners, Rose Lavelle and Sam Mewis. Is it just going to be a Manchester City-Chelsea battle, or can we see Arsenal being in the mix at the top as well?
I think Arsenal will be in the mix. I think their fans are maybe a bit disappointed that they didn't have a big name arrival like the other, you know, top teams did. They have brought in solid players, two important Aussies, Steph Catley and Lydia Williams. Obviously, Joe Montemurro is Australian, so he knows the Aussie game well. And they've still got a fantastic squad. You know, Little, Mead, Nobbs, Miedemar, Van der Donk. So they're a fantastic team. It's just they've now got this reputation for being a small squad, which Montemurro hates. But the fact is they do really suffer when a few players get injured. And now with other teams, especially Chelsea, hoarding so much talent and having such big squads that even if Frank Kirby's not well or injured, doesn't, you know, it barely touches Chelsea now because they've got so many options. And it's the same for Man City as well. Their squad is looking much deeper than it was last season. So I think Arsenal could go down that same route of losing a few players who are now getting a bit older or more prone to injury and then suffering as a result and maybe missing out on the top two and then missing out on Champions League.
However, I suppose working in their favour is this is the final year where it's only two UK teams able to play in the Champions League and Arsenal won't be playing. And that's where Chelsea took advantage last year when they didn't feature in the competition. So maybe that will work in their favour. Just finally, Flo, which other teams are looking good?
I think Reading hopefully might build on some consistent few seasons, finishing fourth, fifth, sixth. Kelly Chambers, a fantastic coach. Everton as well. They lost Chloe Kelly to Manchester City, who's a really exciting England talent. But Willie Kirk, who is quietly becoming a really interesting women's football manager. He was briefly assistant to Casey Stoney at Man U, was also at Bristol City. But he's really sort of established himself at Everton and he's brought in some really interesting signings. So I think Everton and Reading, I'm looking on maybe building on what they've been doing over the last few seasons and potentially pushing and giving teams like Arsenal a bit more trouble.
Brilliant. Flo Lloyd-Hughes, absolute pleasure as always. See you soon.
Thanks all.
So some interesting transfers in the women's game for sure, and obviously always interesting transfers in the men's game as well. Anthony on social media wants to know, have owners for many of the major clubs in Europe lost their minds? Suarez and Dzeko to Juventus, Vidal to Inter. Why are clubs signing players with no legs who have massive wages, especially in the area of pressing, Jonathan Wilson?
I've got absolutely no idea. It's a perfectly good question. Vidal seems to me gone, you know what, 33 now, and his whole game is energy, and that's not there. So I mean, you might get a tune out of him every now and again, but it's not going to be consistent. Dzeko, I've always liked Dzeko as a player, but he's sort of quite an old-fashioned player. I guess he comes into Juve to fill the hole previously occupied by Higuain, that they want sort of a lumbering bloke who scores goals but doesn't really move very much. Although they have Ronaldo to do that these days, I suppose. I just don't really understand the sort of general logic behind it.
And I've watched a bit of Roma this season. Dzeko has been weirdly effective for them, and he doesn't move a whole lot, but he's good just in terms of finishing. And also his sort of link-up plays. I suppose this is Pirlo trying to, you know, set conditions so that they can get the maximum out of Ronaldo, you know, give him like a stationary target man to bounce the ball off and this sort of thing. But it seems a big outlay for a guy who's well old. It might be that just because of COVID, no one wants to like make a massive cash outlay for a younger player. So they just sort of pick up these older dudes for free. But then that doesn't tell you because there's still the wage implications and the sign-on bonuses and all this. They're not necessarily cheaper signings all in. In fact, in the long run, they'll cost you more because you can't sell them on to anyone. So it seems a bit weird.
Well, on the sort of financial implications, I'm really interested why Van der Beek's move to Madrid didn't come off. I mean, I don't know if that's United being ruthless and just sort of nipping in, or whether it's Madrid thinking, you know what, we can't actually afford, you know, 40, 50 million euros, whatever it was. And that, you know, even, you know, a comparatively low fee for a player of proven quality, they're already thinking, yeah, maybe we shouldn't be risking that right now. And that would then suggest that the economic implications of the pandemic are being felt more in Spain than England, or at least feared more in Spain than England.
So it looks like £34 million Van der Beek's fee for United. Is that good business then?
It would seem so to me. I mean, I think he's one of the three outstanding players from that Ajax team. He maybe was the third of the three, but every time I've seen him, he's looked good. I know there's been a lot of talk of does him arriving at United mean that Pogba's on his way out, but I don't think that follows necessarily at all. I think both he and Pogba are very versatile. You can imagine a situation where Pogba plays on the left and he plays on the right. He can play with a three, he can play in a diamond. He could play in the Fernandes role if you want him to. You know, he regularly scores 10 goals a season. I think he's probably good enough to play deep, but he's done that less, but he has done it. So he can occupy any of the four central midfield positions. And I don't know that central midfield was necessarily United's priority, but at the same time, if you get the chance to sign a player of that quality and that age and that profile for £34 million, especially ahead of a season when you're going to be playing games every three and a half days, you need squad depth, particularly in midfield. Why would you not sign him if you can?
Yeah, really good point. Everton doing some decent business by the looks of things. Barry, obviously rumours about James Rodriguez have been around for a while, £20 million touted there. They've also agreed a fee of around £20 million with Watford for the midfielder Abdoulaye Doucouré, who's always been pretty decent for Watford before they were relegated.
Yeah, I think that's a good signing if it comes off. And I'm an admirer of Doucouré's. The thing with Everton is, I applaud their ambition, but you still kind of wonder what exactly is it they're trying to achieve. You know, you can see them finishing seventh. You can't really see them finishing any higher. And I thought Carlo Ancelotti would give them the kick up the arse they needed, but he doesn't seem to have had an immediate effect, but time will tell. James Rodriguez is an interesting one. I think he's a terrific player. He isn't a particularly hard worker, but he has a killer pass. He's supposed to be doing a medical there today, Thursday, I think. So it looks like that's going to happen. And it didn't really work out for him at Real Madrid because Rafael Benitez and Zinedine Zidane, neither of them seem to fancy him much, perhaps because he doesn't have as strong as a work ethic as they would like. But he's kind of the Nico Kranjčar to Carlo Ancelotti's Harry Redknapp. You know, he's played for him at Bayern, he's played for him at Real, and now it looks like he's going to play for him at Everton. And if I was an Everton fan, I'd be pretty excited about that.
Do you see him as a statement signing?
I mean, it is a statement signing. He's a player who, when he joined Real Madrid in 2014, seemed the most exciting prospect in the world. He just won the Golden Boot at the World Cup. He just scored that brilliant goal against Uruguay. And he's had injury problems. He had to have surgery on the metatarsus. He's had a lot of thigh issues. But his best season, certainly in terms of goals and assists, came playing under Ancelotti at Real Madrid. I'm sort of divided on him in that Everton and West Ham both seem to keep going down this route of buying players in their very late 20s or early 30s, thinking they can get one last job out of them. And of course, they're massively expensive in terms of wages, no resale value. And it's not universally true, but that type of player is the type of player who maybe when things get tough don't quite have the hunger that a 20-year-old would have. So, your Javier Hernandez's, your Felipe Anderson's, your Theo Walcott's. Everton and West Ham seem to be two clubs who are sort of trapped in that cycle of signing them. And part of you wants to sort of shake them and say, just sign some 22-year-olds from Augsburg. That's the future. But having said that, it's James Rodriguez going to Everton. If I was an Everton fan, I'd be really excited by this. And there's obviously a slightly weird thing that, it looks like they're going to sign Allen as well. And Allen, I sort of, in my head, is a player who hasn't quite hit his peak yet. And yet he's the same age as James Rodriguez. They're both 29. And of course, Ancelotti's worked with Allen as well. And I think that change that Ancelotti's making to the midfield with Doucouré, Allen and James Rodriguez, it makes it a much more exciting, much more dynamic midfield than they had last season.
John Driffield has a fantastic idea. He says, with Barry's apparent hatred of the transfer window, I don't think it's apparent, I think it's definitely a full-on hatred of the transfer window, should the Premier League instead move to a system like The Voice, where all 20 managers have their back to the stage, whilst transfer targets engage in random sing-songs in the vain hope that the gaffers turn around?
I've never seen The Voice. I've seen it as a television programme.
Oh, Jonathan. Barry, have you seen The Voice?
I am aware of what it is. I don't hate the transfer window. I hate all the white noise and gibbering excitement that surrounds it. And insofar as it's a competition now that's almost more important than the League Cup and FA Cup. You know, Chelsea won the window. I've long maintained that there should be a media blackout regarding transfers. And then at the beginning of the season, you just turn up and see the team that runs out and who's in it. And then you get excited or crushingly disappointed accordingly. And then all the transfer news you need is handed to you in a program, so you find.
Yeah, you wouldn't say that if you were freelance.
No. And also, one giant unveiling, that would just be absolute chaos. A few other things to rattle through. Fans may be allowed to attend Arsenal's home Premier League fixture against Sheffield United on the 3rd of October on a reduced capacity basis. Obviously, we saw 2,500 fans go to a test event at Brighton last weekend. Last week, the Football Supporters Association had discussions with the Premier League, which indicated that 160 of the season's 380 games would not be broadcast live to UK audiences during 2020-21. It means that regular matchgoers will not always be able to watch their team, as fans are not expected to be readmitted to stadiums until October. Jez Garrett wants to know, in recent weeks he says he's been internally rating sports trophies in terms of design of the actual trophy. The Community Shield is the worst, he says. The Europa League, one of my favourites by far. Any other opinions?
Well, I think the Europa League trophy is, with the possible exception of the World Cup, the nicest looking trophy in sport. I was reading recently about the design of the Champions League trophy, and basically it was some Swiss dude rocked up at FIFA HQ with a load of drawings, and whoever had commissioned the trophy went, well, the Bulgarians, they'd like that kind of base. The Russians would like handles, those kind of handles. The English would like that kind of neck. And that's how it was. It's basic mishmash of lots of different designs. So the potential for disaster there seemed to be huge. And I reckon it turned out pretty nice all the same.
So I think the worst one is the Premier League trophy by far.
Why?
It just looks really tacky and crass. I mean, it's appropriate, but it's a nouveau riche trophy. It's the kind of thing that a small time dictator would have in their bathroom. Yeah, that would be his shower fitting.
What do you want them to give? Like a small wooden cup. Like the Holy Grail of Indiana Jones.
That would be. I mean, look, that is literally what the Ashes is, right? It's a very small urn. I think the claret jug we used to have in the we still have in the championship, but used to be, you know, the title, is an incredibly attractive thing. It's very shiny. It's the shiniest thing I've ever seen, and that sort of serves a purpose because you can serve claret out of it. The only one I don't like, actually, I think, is the Premier League. It just looks naff.
I think with regards to how it's going in terms of ownership in England, I mean, it is probably the major trophy that is most likely to be kept in a small-time dictator's bathroom at some point in the future. So that just, maybe that is appropriate.
I think the thing I like about the World Cup is it looks like Sepp Blatter's fallen a vat of custard and then just got out and it's still kind of dripping off him. And that I think is... That, I think, is deeply appropriate.
Right, that's it for part two. Coming up in part three, with the help of BT TV, we're going to do something we've never done before this week, giving one of you listeners a chance to present the climax of the show in the BT TV Football Weekly Host Super Sub. Now, with the help of BT TV, we're going to do something that we've never done before on the show until this week. Two deserving Football Weekly listeners have won themselves a chance to present the climax of the show in the BT TV Football Weekly Host Super Sub. Just like Mario Götze for Germany in the 2014 World Cup final, or Marouane Fellaini and Nasser Chadli for Belgium in 2018, a late canny substitution can make all the difference. So I'm going to be heading off shortly for an early bath, leaving one of our listeners 5 minutes to captain the UK's greatest football pod and ask the most knowledgeable football panel out there whatever they want about the game. That's coming up in just a moment, but what's the inspiration for this? Well, BT TV is flexible and allows football fans like you unlimited substitutions, so you can change your football packages every month. You can now get the Now TV Sky Sports Pass, BT Sport and Prime Video, so you can sub all the football on and off every month. You can search BT TV after the show to find out more. Since we put the call out on the show a couple of weeks ago, hundreds of you have written in with your pitches for why we should choose you to guest present. We've read them all and we've whittled them down. And today is the turn of our second BT TV Football Weekly Host Super Sub, Johnny Hyman. Johnny, hello. So lovely to have you with us. How are you?
I'm really well. Thanks, Faye. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. Tell us a bit about yourself. Have there been any football-related epiphanies for you over the years?
Well, I think I'd like to cover my first love, football, which is Bolton. You know, I'm a keen player myself, but I limit myself to a kick around on the Power League pitches in five-a-side form of the game.
Tell us why Bolton.
Well, I grew up in the Northwest, got quite a close sort of connection to them. I used to drive past the stadium right next to the motorway and the retail park pretty much every day. So, you know, I've been with them in the high points and also very much in the low points too.
Yeah, well, I mean, well done for that, because it's been difficult times for you, for sure. Now, in your competition entry, you said, "I knew this was the Guardians competition rather than the Athletics," when you only gave us 500 words rather than 500 pages. That already curried you favour, so well done for that. You suggested, though, that Football Weekly would make a solid, if unspectacular, five-a-side team playing down the local Power League in one of those pitches that's more like a cage-fighting arena. Tell us a little bit more about your entry, because I want to know exactly what you wanted Lars to be doing.
Every one of these teams has the same kind of characters, and I think they compare quite nicely to the members of the pod, so I'm quite glad you're handing over to me, Faye, rather than Max, because I was I think I compared him to the type of person who would play in a five-a-side kickabout and constantly complain to a ref that isn't even there. but Lars's role I had as the kind provider of the half-time oranges, although hey. In certain occasions the oranges would be replaced by last night's roast dinner.
What was your joke? Because I loved this. As long as it hadn't gone moulder.
Yeah, I'm sure Lars has said that one before.
If it's bad, I probably have.
But come on. Up front, sharpshooter Barry Glendenning, come off it.
Yeah, I sort of saw Barry as the mercurial sharpshooter up top with a good eye for goal on his day. The rest of the team are looking at him, just wondering what's going on.
So you live in Brixton, same as Barry, and said you'd been on the receiving end of Barry leaning out of a window armed with a super soaker in the early hours, and you know he can hit a target. So do you ever find out what the liquid was in the super soaker?
Oh, well, that would be telling, Faye. I'll just say I won't be walking past his flat at 3 o'clock in the morning anytime soon.
Wow. With that, I'm going to hand you over to Johnny Hyman. It's all yours.
Thanks very much, Faye. Well, I think my section presenting here really would start on the 8th of November 2007 at the Allianz Arena. This evening was the night when Bayern Munich, who I needn't remind anyone last week, beat PSG in the Champions League final, drew 2-2 at home in the UEFA Cup to a Bolton Wanderers starting 11. Including Andy O'Brien, Danny Guthrie and Gavin McCann. These were probably the best days in modern memory for Bolton, but we'll be playing this coming season alongside Barrow and Salford City in League Two. You know, this kind of slump has not just happened to Bolton. In recent years, we've seen similar kind of things happen to Wigan, your beloved Sunderland, and obviously Leeds, who went from Champions League to League One in the space of about 6 years. And the concept of plummeting quickly down the pyramid even has its own Wikipedia page called Doing a Leeds. So I'd like to throw it open to the panel and ask, you know, what causes such a slump? And is there really any reason in particular why it seems that some northern clubs have been particularly affected by this?
I'm not sure. It's specifically northern. If you look at Portsmouth, or earlier than them, Wimbledon, you look at what Charlton are going through, you look at Leighton Orient, look at QPR, look at Birmingham, look at Coventry, look at Ipswich. You know, it's a problem across the country. Is there are more clubs in the north, and therefore maybe it appears to be more of a problem for the north. And I think there is sort of there has definitely been a trend over the last 100 years when the league first began. So, you know, league first begins 1888. The big teams were big industrial cities of the Midlands and the North. I think you see sort of across world football that increasingly, and you know, it's obviously different in democracy to a authoritarian state. In totalitarian states, the capital always tend to have the big clubs. But I think increasingly just the growing influence and wealth of capitals in a globalised world means that the focus shifts there. But I mean, I think that's a process that's been going on for a long, long time. So, but I don't think it's a specifically northern thing at all.
Bolton just seemed to have, I think it was once Eddie Davis left. He was a good owner, but when he left, they suddenly found themselves 170 million quid in debt, owing over half a million to Her Majesty in unpaid taxes. And it just seems to have gone from bad to worse still ever since. And now I suppose they're in League Two. They have a chance to reset. As things stand without a game played, they're second in the table in alphabetical order. That's a good start. Automatic promotion. And I suppose you just have to hope that most of the gas has gone out of the Bolton explosion and Ian Evatt can get them on the road to recovery. I don't know how you feel about his appointment. He has experience of taking a team out of League Two into the conference in Chesterfield. So,
yeah, there are some disappointing marks on his record, but I think generally we would look at it as a really positive appointment, young manager, and with some of the signings that are coming already, I'm quite impressed by Owen Doyle as a signing and Nathan Delfonso as well. So, you know, I think we would look happily at the prospects for this season, but you know, we're talking about a team that had Okocha, Djorkaeff, Stelios, Hierro, Campo, and then the bubble burst all rather quickly.
And Danny Guthrie.
I'm kind of thrilled by your 2010-2011 squad, in which you had famously had Marcos Alonso, who was in there, and Rodrigo, who's now sound for Leeds, he was in there, alongside Daniel Sturridge. I mean, I don't need to Bolton-splain to you, but I'm guessing some of our listeners are not aware of what a smorgasbord of wonderful things. Ali Al-Habsi was in, I don't think he played any games that year, but he was there. Lee Chung-Yung, some terrific players, but and you stayed up that year as well, I guess. But it's really actually, not to rub salt into it, Jonathan, but it is quite fun now going through the Bolton squads, going just, oh, look, he was there. I forgot about that.
What I would ask, I think, to the panel off the back of this is there a blueprint for reversing such a slump like this? Does it seem like it's best done organically by sort of resetting, going back to basics? Or do you want to get out of the mire as quickly as possible? And, you know, if a change of culture is required, is this best achieved by hiring a pioneering Argentinian manager like Leeds did, or by, you know, getting a new DJ and blasting Ibiza-style dance anthems before kickoff?
I mean, obviously, yeah, there's not one way. So if you can persuade an evil state to take you over and put in billions of pounds, that seems quite a quick route to the top. I'm not sure how healthy that is. If you can get Bielsa to come, that's also a great route to the top. But I think really, you got to sort of ask, what do you want your football club to be? And I think we've also got to accept there are super clubs and non-super clubs, and you know, the game's different for them. So, and I say this from a fairly, you know, I realise my perspective is slightly skewed by the fact I don't live in Sunderland anymore. And so I go to, 8-10 games a season? I'm not watching them every week. But I would rather have a team that's run properly, playing at a lower level and having fun and doing things right, and developing young talent, and you know, ideally being sort of well connected with the community and representing that community as best that club can, rather than a bunch of mercenaries who disappear as soon as as soon as there's a sniff of relegation in the air.
Well, in terms of turning things around, I think, I mean, if you're thinking of a blueprint for Bolton, for instance, I think you should take heart from the fact that Brentford got really close to getting promoted. I mean, it is possible to rise through the sort of the football leagues here if you make a lot of smart decisions. You don't have to go that far back to find sort of Brighton down in the third division. Sheffield United, obviously, were in League One for a long time. I mean, it is possible to go up there if you make a string of smart decisions, but I don't think there's any blueprint as such, no?
I think there is, for now, hope remains, although that's possibly become harder with the salary cap in Leagues 1 and 2, because I think the gulf between League 1 and the Championship, which was already pretty significant, will only get bigger through that. But then if you're not buying success, you know, if you're developing your own players and you have a coherent style, maybe that is less of an issue.
Yeah, I think it seems to me as though there's hope, but particularly with the introduction of the salary cap, clubs will have to get their house in order and come up that way, more so than in the past. And I think with bearing that in mind, I think my last question would be, you know, because we haven't flogged the issue of Lionel Messi enough over the last few days and weeks, I'd like to just assume an alternate reality where Messi is lured to Bolton Wanderers this summer transfer window. I don't think it's out of the question. You know, it's a club with great train links. It's got Horwich Parkway Station nearby, and there's a massive home bargains right next to the stadium. So it's not out of the question. And if this were to happen, how many goals would Lionel Messi score in League Two, and would he be able to win that league on his own?
I'd like to think it's like a dad joining in with a group of very small children and just running amok and, you know, winning games single-handedly by scoring 12 goals. But presumably he'd just get the ankles kicked off him and get very fed up very quickly.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure it's the issue of him being kicked is that big, because he gets kicked anyway. He's good at, he's, you know, he one of his great strengths as a player is his balance and his ability to avoid tackles. I think the bigger issue is sort of the rest. It's not the opponents. It's Bolton, and would players be making runs to create space for him? What sort of ball is he going to get? Because if it ends up being 10 men behind the ball, whacking it long at him, that's not playing to his strengths, and he's just, you know, he will get out muscled by big League Two centre backs. So if you can get the ball to him, and if other players can make runs off him to create space, then yeah, he could score sort of 80 goals a season, because he would score free kicks, right? Yeah, every time he got a free kick, there's a very good chance he'd score at that level.
He would score more goals than Sunderland are going to score in League One this season.
Yes, although if he were playing up front with Will Grigg and Charlie Wyke, perhaps not.
See, that wasn't a question, that was an assertion. That was like, that is what would happen.
Is Will Grigg still at Sunderland? I thought he'd gone.
You can't get rid of him on those wages with a salary cap, can you? Unless we get a championship club to buy him, which that's not going to happen.
Thanks, everyone. Wait and see what happens this season.
Ah, lovely stuff. Thoroughly enjoyed that. Well done to Johnny Hyman for being today's super sub. Thanks so much. That's pretty much it for today as well. Remember to check out BTTV online now. It's flexible with unlimited substitutions. You can get the Now TV Sky Sports Pass, BT Sport and Prime Video, so you can change your football package every month. Always a pleasure with this panel. Wilson, thank you.
Cheers, thank you.
Lars Sivertsen, always a pleasure to see you.
Thanks, Faye.
Barry, whatever.
Thanks, Faye.
Max will be back from his well-earned break on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.